The hour of 10 a.m. having arrived, I am going to call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. We have on the agenda today. All right. We've got a general discussion of part of the outline that we started last week, this one dealing with committees. And I'm going to have Mr. Shepherd walk us through a summary of that, and it should be in your packet entitled Committee Structure and Procedure, Policy Considerations and Potential Changes. So we'll just take a minute for members to get that out. And then if Mr. Shepherd would walk us through it. Mr. Shepherd.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Last time when you met, I had distributed a general outline of the entire legislative process with some ideas for changes and policy considerations. And what we did this time, because the focus is on the committee structure, was to expand just the committee part of those. So this memo today for your consideration, first of all, sets out some general policy considerations that the legislature could consider in establishing the committee structure. And then it lists some possible changes in committee structure and procedures that could be considered. And these changes are developed pretty much from the discussion that you all have had before and from things that NCSL has mentioned and other ideas that have come up. Obviously, this is not all-inclusive. There's probably a lot of other ideas that others might have for this. At the beginning, I've just noted some of the reasons why legislatures have committees at all, to decentralize power, divide workload, allow legislators to build expertise in part by hearing testimony from the public, to reduce the volume of work for the full body, and allowing details of legislation to be shaped in small groups. So what I've done through the rest of the memo, and I'll just take about 2 minutes to highlight it because you can then discuss whatever you'd like in any detail, is I have tried to organize for your discussion purposes some of the themes that have come up in the prior discussions and in the NCSL materials. The first major subheading has to do with the structure of the committees and the membership of the committees, and some of the themes, sub-themes there are to increase cooperation between House and Senate committees in a variety of ways, possible reduction in the number of committees or divisions, or reducing the number of members serving on each committee or division so that each member would serve on fewer committees, providing that subcommittees would consist primarily or entirely of members of the parent committees, and then a topic that has been discussed on and off for a number of bienniums, modifying methods of appointing members to committees. So those all have to do with the structure and membership of committees. The second main topic is limiting bill introductions. This is one that there was some testimony from NCSL on. There are various ways that that could be done, limiting the number of bills that each member can introduce, allowing a larger number of authors on bills to avoid duplicate bills, and creating a deadline for initial bill introductions to kind of start the funneling process a little bit earlier in the legislative process. The third major subheading at the bottom of page 2 has to do with the procedures relating to referrals or re-referral of bills to committees. The first point is one that Representative Broad mentioned last week, which is considering establishing a nonpartisan mechanism for initial bill referrals. The second point, there was some discussion on last meeting also, allowing bills to be considered simultaneously in multiple committees. On the top of page 3, the potential for limiting the jurisdiction of secondary committees to matters within the jurisdiction of those committees. The rules don't currently define what is a primary or a secondary committee, so if this were to occur, then there would have to be some mechanism for deciding that. But in general, the thought here is that if you have a bill dealing with natural resources as its primary topic, and it also has civil penalties and rulemaking, that the natural resource committees would be primary and the other ones would be secondary, and that perhaps the secondary committees would have limited jurisdiction to those topics that are the reason why the bill was re-referred. I note there, and this applies to many of the points in this memo, that most of these changes could be done either informally, by custom, or if you wanted, by rule, or even statute. So there's a variety of ways, if you decided to implement these changes, of doing it. Finally, on this, limiting the number of secondary committees to which bills are re-referred. Point D, major heading D, I've tried to organize for your discussions some items relating to scheduling and the agenda of committees. One would be trying to ensure that each member would be able to get hearings on bills in committees, at least under specified circumstances. There's been some comments about stricter standards for public notice of committee agendas, including perhaps notice of the major amendments that would be considered. Customs, scheduling practices, and rules for ensuring that committee meetings begin at the scheduled time. Perhaps stricter standards for making amendments to be offered in committee publicly available in advance. And last week there was a discussion, and in the past it's been discussed, the notion of having policy committee deadlines go later in the session so that committees could hear bills longer than they do now. Major heading E, the last major subheading, I've just grouped a number of ideas under the title of the work of committees in general. The first subpoint under that would be the expectation that committees would resolve most technical policy and political issues so that you wouldn't have as many of these coming up on the floor. And obviously this could be done informally by custom of the House, or perhaps by a rule that would facilitate sending bills back to the floor even after deadlines if more work needed to be done. A topic that has been discussed in the past, limiting omnibus budget bills to budget-related material, again, could be done either by an incremental custom or by a rule. And if it were a rule, it could be a House rule or a joint rule. And, of course, how you shape that would have some effect on the dynamics between the House and the Senate if you didn't have parallel rules. And finally, on the top of page 4, the possibility of having a stricter germaneness rule for bills and committees. Again, something that could be done incrementally by custom or House rules or joint rules could limit amendments and committees that are related to matters that are related to the jurisdiction of the committee. Mr. Chair, that's just a quick walkthrough, and I'd be happy to help answer questions at any time.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. I know a number of you had sent in suggestions, and we'll be taking those too. I believe we have one person who wished to testify today, and if you'd want to come down, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record. My name is Jeff Clark. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Governmental Relations Council. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. Minnesota Governmental Relations Council, or MGRC, is an association of over 500 governmental professionals that were the lobbyists you see running around the Capitol, often getting in your way. But we're organized to advance the ethical and professional standards of legislative representation and to preserve the constitutional rights of legislative petition and free speech. We applaud the work that's being done by this committee to review our legislative process and to look for ways on how the current process could be improved. I'd like to keep my comments today focused on the outlines that Mr. Melander and Mr. Shepard put together, particularly on committee structure. And my comments and suggestions today are made with the intention to improve the ability of citizens to understand and participate in the process. We believe that a committee process that is more transparent and also more structured is a benefit to the public. And we also believe that a committee process that produces well-structured and thoughtfully debated legislation can reduce the amount of activity and debate, both good and bad, that we're seeing occur on the House and the Senate floors. And specifically, we'd like to recommend the following from the list of potential changes. First, I'm going to apologize for the length of what I'm about to go through, and then I'm also going to be very clear. As a lobbyist who's up at the Capitol every day, We follow the rules that are in process or the standards of action. And that means that everything I'm about to propose here is a potential change. I've been on the side where I didn't like the fact that people were playing by these rules, and I've been on the side where I've taken advantage of these rules. And so everything I go through is going to impact us, but you think at the end of the day, they're likely to produce a better outcome. And the first is to increase cooperation between House and Senate committees. Coordination between committees and hearing schedules would make it easier for the public to follow legislation. There's a growing number of instances where House and Senate committees of like jurisdiction are meeting on the same days and often at the same time. This particularly happens when we get close to committee deadlines and additional hearings are being added to the agendas. And this makes it very difficult for the public to participate in the process because now we have to choose, do we follow the House or Senate committee, sometimes when bills of interest to them are on both sides. This coordination between the House and Senate is especially important in the Finance and Budget Committees. The House and Senate right now really do not have a similar structure. The Senate has a Finance Committee and 10 Budget Divisions. The House has a Ways and Means Committee, a Finance Committee, and 14 Finance Divisions. And what this ultimately leads to is some type of floor action in either the House or the Senate to line the bills up before they go to Conference Committee. And that just means for the general citizen who's trying to follow this process, they've got to try to understand what that step is or where this piece of funding went from one bill to the next, and that's not always explained in those amendments, so it makes it difficult for them to follow. We might also suggest coordination of administration between the House and Senate. Simply having the websites work in a more identical fashion will make it easier for citizens to follow and track legislation between one body and the next. Secondly, the recommendation to reduce the number of committees. The vast number of committees and subcommittees has really created an overlap of jurisdiction and forced many bills to be seen by numerous committees or subcommittees. Certainly there are some, and I would say many pieces of legislation that require multiple stops because of the nature of the legislation, but many bills now have two or three additional stops just because of this overlap. We've created so many committees that have got to go through three or four different places, and this puts additional stress on legislation to make tight committee deadlines. More and more bills are being sent from one committee to the next with work left to be done, and we keep hearing the phrase, this bill has a lot of stops to make before it gets to the floor. I'm sure all the interested parties will work together on it. And everyone does with good intentions, but we should be reducing the number of times we're actually using that phrase, not increasing it. Along those same lines, re-referrals are limiting committee action to matters of jurisdiction. Many committee chairs do make a point to hold debate to the issues in that or in the bill that the committee has jurisdiction over, but amendments, and often it's particularly authors' amendments when they're doing cleanup from the last committee's work, aren't always held to those same guidelines. So when an author or a member is making substantial changes to a portion of a bill dealing with, for example, healthcare policy in the Government Operations Committee, you've got the wrong committee making action on those changes, even if it's the author bringing them to the committee as a technical change. They're often very, very policy-oriented. And when policy amendments are being offered to the bill in the Ways and Means of the Finance Committee, again, you're bypassing the policy committee that has jurisdiction over those issues and making those changes in another committee. Right now, the Committee of Original Referral really has the least ability to determine the final outcome of the bill, because you can work on it all the way through the process, so the first stop, it looks the least like the final version once it gets out of that stop. By limiting action on legislation to matters of jurisdiction, we are assuring the right committees making these decisions, and we're holding policy committees, and we're holding the public accountable to have legislation in the shape it desires before it leaves the committee. And that leads to the final, to establish an expectation that in most cases, committees will not recommend bills to pass until technical policy and political issues have been resolved. And the last two issues really speak to this. There's no expectation currently that a committee produces a final version of the legislation or even versions of legislation that would be supported by the committee if they weren't changed. Bills are going out of here with the expectation or comments that, I won't vote for this on the floor unless it changes, but I'll vote for it now to move it along the process. We should be working to fix these changes in the policy committee. I have no doubt that every committee chair and every member wants the bill in the best shape possible by the time they leave the committee, but it's not happening because there's too much pressure to hear too many bills in too short of a time frame. It leads to a rubber stamp with a promise to fix everything later. So there's no accountability to the Committee of Jurisdiction, and this is what leads to the significant amendments throughout the committee process and then also on the floor. Because it's not been worked out in the original committee, it's now open for not only necessary but also unnecessary amendments and debate in the long process we have on the House and Senate floors. It's not a bad thing for a policy committee to spend more than one hearing on a very complex piece of legislation. In fact, that would be a welcome change. Every time a law is changed, it affects someone, sometimes significantly. So slowing down to make sure it's done right and that the committees with the most expertise and knowledge support that change would be a major improvement. This would also make it much clearer to the public where action on bills is happening and where they should and where they need to be accountable to the process, too. There's an expectation that the committees are going to produce at least a more final version of the product, then that means the public and the rest of us need to be invested in that committee and not working around it saying, well, let's wait and fix it in this committee because we know we've got the votes over here, even though they don't have jurisdiction. Not that that's ever happened. Establishing stricter maintenance rules for bills and committees. Common practice seems to be that anything that sounds familiar and that no one objects to is fair game. And that makes it almost impossible for the public to know, you know, when language or amendments might be added to a bill and what the impact of that language is. When you add this to the fact that committees are not limiting discussion always to a bill or on a bill to the areas where they have jurisdiction, you have this potential for mischief or sort of a surprise amendment effect. Lobbyists, we try to have someone in every committee, and whether or not there's a bill in that committee that we really think we're working on, and we do this because we have no idea what amendment's going to come up to what bill and what committee, and you need to be there so that you can see it and react to it. We still miss things. So imagine you're the public who's not having someone sit in all these hearings trying to follow the process and pay attention to what's going on. It's impossible for them to do. By having stricter germaneness rules, it would also improve the process to have more structure about what bills or really what statutes that bills affect are required to go through which committees. We do run into situations where chairs have the ability to determine whether or not they feel a bill needs to be referred to their committee. Oh, I do need to see that. I don't need to see that. If there was some more structure around bills affecting this statute have to be seen by this committee, it would make it clear rather than leave that up to determination. And then imposing stricter standards for public notice of committee agendas. And let me just say this. If no other recommendations are made, we would strongly encourage this committee to suggest stricter standards for public notice of committee hearings and the bills to be debated at those hearings. There are countless examples of committee agendas changing 24, 12, or even 1 or 2 hours before the hearing. And really, this is a result of technology allowing us to do that, but it's an abuse of technology and it's abuse of our requirements for public notice of hearings. When agendas change so rapidly, there's no time for the public or interested parties to prepare, and there's little or no time for legislators to prepare the bills that get added to the agenda right before a hearing. The rapidly changing agendas also contribute to this pile-up of bills that need to be heard. So the more we allow the agendas to change right up to the last minute, the more bills get added, the more pressure there is to move bills through the process out of the next committee to hear, to meet timelines. And there's really no reason why committee agendas cannot be set at least 48 hours in advance of a hearing. And I would say 48 hours would be a minimum. This will improve transparency and participation by the public, and actually places accountability on legislators and the public to have their bills and legislation in shape before the hearing. In addition to requiring public notice of bills to be heard, we would encourage that a requirement that bills in their language be publicly available before they're added to the agenda. House file XXXX being scheduled for a hearing the next day is really inexcusable. Oftentimes, these XXX bills are the major policy or major financing bills, and the public has no way to know what's included in these bills that are going to be heard and often acted on in a very quick manner the next day. Again, we're up here, and I'm up here every day. So if I know the author, I can get to their office and get a copy, a sneak advance copy of it, and work through it and get my amendments drafted and hopefully impacted. But someone, a member of the public who's just trying to pay attention, has no idea what House File XXXX even means, let alone being able to get over here and try to sift through a 300-page bill as it's being heard. In addition to that, imposing stricter standards on making amendments to be offered in committee publicly available, along with the proper notice for agendas requiring standards for drafting of amendments and making amendments available, can have a dramatically positive effect on the public's ability to participate in this process. This type of advanced notice of amendments would also improve the ability of committees to process work in a timely, efficient, and knowledgeable manner. So if agendas are required to be submitted at least 48 hours in advance, and, you know, amendments can be required to be submitted 24 hours in advance and hopefully publicly available hours before the hearing. And if that's not enough time to make some of these amendments available, push everything back. I mean, imagine how much easier it would be if you, as committee members, knew what amendments were coming up, to what bills that were coming up, and had everyone like myself who was trying to tell you, you know, what this legislation and what this amendment was coming, if you actually had the opportunity to read it, understand it, and hear both sides when it was brought up in the committee. The debate would be better, there would be greater understanding among the committee and the public about what was happening, and the production, moving the bill from one committee to the next, would be clear and have a better representation of the will of the committee. This also, again, gets, you know, rid of this tactic that I've used many times in the past, where you have an amendment that might be technical in nature that really has a greater significant impact, but you just offer it in a committee without necessarily making it publicly available, and because of its technical nature, no one really knows what it does, and it may do something significant. And particularly if you can offer this in a committee that doesn't have jurisdiction, you may have just, you know, put something, whether they're DACA or sneakies or whatever amendments in place, and I don't think that's the way we want to be impacting laws in this state. So by having stricter timelines or stricter requirements on the agendas and the amendments, you're really holding legislators, and I would say even more so the public, accountable to having their information ready and available for those hearings. And then finally, one that wasn't on the list but that we would add would be that finance committees have fiscal notes prepared before passing legislation and not including language in finance bills that has not received a policy committee hearing. This, again, is something that's happening with a little more regularity. In the last year, both finance divisions and full finance committees have passed legislation without having their fiscal notes signed off by the Department of Finance, and I know the fiscal note process is something that others are looking into. Actually, in one case this year, we had a full body pass a budget bill with incomplete fiscal notes, and they had to go back and actually amend their version of the language in a conference committee, which I don't know if that's been done before, because they were in such a rush, they moved through, you know, their budget bill without having the fiscal notes signed off. These are bad, bad precedents. All the language and finance bills should have the opportunity to be reviewed and commented on by the public, and the Finance Committee and the Budget Division should have a clear understanding of what the fiscal implication of these bills are before they move on or out of their committee. Mr. Chairman and members, I apologize for the length of my testimony, but our organization does have some strong feelings on these issues, and I want to provide this committee with as much information as possible. I'd be happy to provide any other thoughts. I know Mr. Griffin has appeared before this committee before with some thoughts or examples. We've asked our membership to provide some additional ones, and as we compile that list, we'll be happy to share them with you as well.
Mr. Butch, thank you, and don't apologize. That's what the committee is for, and we'll take as much time as is needed to get all the information. Your website began collecting information after the initial hearing that we had in this committee a couple of months ago. And I would appreciate it that you would continually update not just this committee, but any members of the body that wish to have that information. You were very helpful in articulating what happens when a major policy or finance bill goes to the floor and amendments start being offered to it, particularly amendments that were never introduced as a bill, never had a hearing. And it isn't an isolated case. It's now about 50% in some cases of the amendments that are offered. So, are there any questions that anyone wishes to ask? Representative Grant, welcome to the committee, and we hope that you'll stay with us until the end. Thank you,
Chair Plusky. I hope so, too. I'm very interested in this. I'm very glad you're doing it, and I appreciate the testimony. And I'm wondering, has the Minnesota Government Relations Council ever given us a model, from your perspective, a model committee structure for the Senate and the House? Mm-hmm. You gave us great hints. But I think that would be something useful as well.
Mr. Barsh.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grine, you know, we haven't produced a formal recommendation or model of what we think would be the right thing to do. We can certainly take back the thoughts and recommendations I had and maybe put them in a little more structure for you if that would be helpful.
Representative Grine, there is, and I think it's in the original packet, and you may have picked it up, the testimony from Mr. Griffin, and we'll incorporate this testimony today too. And then their website actually has been very helpful from the various members who have contributed information to it. So we're using them as much as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For Mr. Barsh, I am intrigued by the idea of a policy bill or a bill not moving from a committee until the technical and political issues have been resolved. And I'm wondering if you can offer us maybe your ideas, or if you thought about what would be objective measures on meeting that criteria.
Ms. Barsh.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I guess that's a decision for the committee as a whole, and it would really be the chair of that committee. I would suggest that there would always be instances where, you know, a bill or a piece of legislation isn't agreed to by everyone on the committee, and I don't know if we're ever going to get to that point. But I think you can certainly have the opportunity where a piece of legislation where all the issues of contention are at least raised and debated and decided or voted on one way or another, and that the chair of the committee can, in his or her judgment, you know, really feel, and I would think in most cases, get agreement by the minority that they've had a full vetting of the issues in the bill. I think too often now what we have is a number of issues raised, not enough time to go through those issues in the committee, and a recommendation by the author of the bill, in all good intentions, and almost always they fall through, but to work on it throughout the process. And that's what leads to committees of non-jurisdiction deciding those issues. So, you know, obviously it would be an objective criteria, but I think in most cases the chairs of the committee would just know that they are accountable to have a full hearing on the bill and vet the issues that are before it.
Representative Murphy, when we took testimony from NCSL, they presented us with Oregon and Utah's solution, which is simply no floor amendment. Floor amendment that goes back to committee. That may be a little draconian for Minnesota, but it does illustrate that there are mechanisms that can be used to make sure that the committees do their work. Another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Barsh, the legislature hit a new high watermark this past session with the number of bills introduced. And in your tenure, as you've been, you know, hanging around here for quite a while, I am wondering if you have a sense of whether or not we're hearing more bills or hearing the same number of bills. So we're introducing more bills. But I don't know if we're hearing, I haven't been at this long enough, I don't know if we're hearing more bills, we're trying to push more through the process or not. I'm wondering if you have a read on that.
Ms. Barsh.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I just go off my own personal feelings, but it sure feels like we're hearing more bills. And I would think that's just sort of the nature of things. When you've got an increasing number of bills that are referred to committee, there's an increasing amount of pressure to hear more and more of those bills. And so I would say from my experience, and I'm sure there's others around the room who have been here and doing this longer than I have, that we are hearing more and more bills. And I think part of that, again, is this idea that we'll just continue on working things until they get to the House or Senate floor. You know, we used to have, and we have committee deadlines, but now we're sort of ignoring those committee deadlines, too. So a bill may not meet deadline in the House, or it might not meet deadline in the Senate, but that doesn't mean the House or Senate doesn't continue to have hearings on that bill, which raises the question, why have committee deadlines in the first place? So there's more and more instances of that, and I do think we're producing more and more work. Technology has allowed us to do this. I think you have more people, either through professional representation or themselves, who are involved in the process, and so there's more of a need or want to affect legislation, and that's all good, but that doesn't necessarily mean we need to be producing more laws, more changes, or particularly more bills that don't result in changes to law.
I've got Representative Simon next. Representative Simon.
Oh, but it's Representative Murphy had a...
Oh, Representative Murphy, do you have one more? Go ahead.
Thank
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm good, thank you.
Okay, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barsh, just a couple, I wanted to get your view on a couple of things. If you look on page 3 of the handout that we received here, I think you were echoing some of the comments on letter E1, expect committees to resolve most technical policy and political issues. It's that last term, political, that I think could be potentially troubling. After all, that's what we do here. We can't take the politics out of politics. And if that phrase means that before a bill comes to committee, everyone's holding hands and agreeing, then I think we've got problems. I think you'd agree. And I don't think that's what you meant by it, unless you did, in which case you should tell us. But one frustration that I, and I know many, many other members have had, and I experienced this with the Senate committee chair this year, and I think it's well-intentioned, but this committee chair said on two occasions, with two bills that I was involved with, not necessarily chief author, this committee chair said, well, I'll only give it a hearing if everyone can agree beforehand. If all the stakeholders get together and agree on a compromise, I'll hear it, and then we'll do it. But think of what that does. That basically says to an author of a bill, you know those people who hate your idea? Get in a room with them and agree, and unless the people who hate your idea endorse and bless your idea in some form, I'm not going to hear the bill. Now, I'm sure that's not what the intention is, but that's oftentimes, you know, what does happen. And maybe the chair just doesn't like the bill, and maybe this is a way of that person saying that. I don't think so in these cases. So I think, although we want compromise, and we want people to come to some kind of accommodation, ultimately, I just want clarification that what you didn't mean is that everyone should be kind of holding hands and agreeing before we have a committee hearing on the bill. Is that true?
Ms. Fresh.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon. I think it's similar to one of the questions that Representative Murphy raised, but clearly we're never going to get to a point where everyone on a committee agrees to a piece of legislation before it's passed or heard. I think regardless of any changes you make, many chairs will try to get parties on both sides trying to work together in the best way they can. I think what we're referring to in this recommendation is that committee hearings hold the full embedded debate on a piece of legislation so that all the issues of concern are raised and decided one way or another. Not everyone's going to be happy. And your question about political issues, you know, I don't know where in the process you get rid of political issues, nor do I know that you ever want to try to attempt, because that's not going to work. But I would agree with you that these comments are meant to suggest that committees have more accountability and do a more thorough vetting of the bill with the expectation that it's in a state that the committee as a whole recommends and would be pleased with final passage of before it moves forward.
Thank you. Just a couple other issues I want to get your opinion on. I completely agree, and I told Chair Pawlowski that I agree that there should be stricter deadlines for committee amendments and for the agendas. I think that's a great idea, 24, even 48 hours. But I think that I'm interested in what you think about the idea of maybe an exception for the chief author of the bill or the chief author's designated person if the chief author doesn't sit on the committee. The reason I say that is it might be, it seems to me, the case that the chief author is the one doing a lot of negotiating behind the scenes. And it may be that there's a Monday committee hearing, just like this one, which means with a 48-hour rule, let's say that by Friday the agenda had to go out. But let's say over the weekend there were heated late-night negotiations and an accommodation was reached. And sides that were at war with one another before Friday were now on the same page and were, in fact, holding hands and agreeing on a compromise version. It seems to make sense to me that only the chief author or the chief author's designee on that committee, and we could maybe create some official way to determine who that person would, checking a box or filling out a piece of paper or something, that it seems to me not unreasonable that in that circumstance that there could be a committee amendment for that Monday morning hearing that is the product of those weekend negotiations. What do you think about that, making an exception for having a strict deadline process or notice process for amendments and for bills that are going to be in hearings, but making an exception for the chief author to accommodate the circumstance that I just described?
Ms. Clark.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, you raise an interesting, I think, scenario that happens a lot of time where it's that pressure for timelines that gets both parties to sit down and agree to something that they might not otherwise have. I don't think we want to lose that. I would suggest there might be a couple ways to make that exception process work. The first would be, if there is agreement, you can always push the bill then off to the next committee hearing. So notice doesn't preclude you from pushing it off a day further on the agenda, which would give the public notice on the agreed to amendment. The second is, if you want to create some exception for the author of the bill or their designee, and it's going against what would be the recommended timeline, you know, maybe that's a situation where the committee has to agree and take action on that exception to the rule. You know, then at least it's an issue of public record where the committee has said, you know, this is not meeting the 24-hour rule, whatever it is, but we recognize the author's work. And, you know, then again, you have to have limitations on where the committee makes exceptions and where they don't. It's an interesting situation. I'm sure it's one that comes up, but I think there's ways to get around it. What I would be hesitant to do is create a process where that type of exception could be used often. And I think now in most cases where the author of a piece of legislation comes before a committee with an amendment that deals with policy changes that were debated in a previous committee, it's the assumption that those were worked out and that the new amendment, although maybe technical, will incorporate some of those agreements. And, you know, 99% of the time, that's what's happening. But it's happening with, you know, it's happening very frequently now. And I don't want to create an exception process that would allow that to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That sounds reasonable. I like the idea of being able to push the hearing out or have the committee vote on whether to suspend the rule. That seems to make sense to me to accommodate the thing that I was describing. One other thing, you mentioned, and I think we've all experienced, because of the sheer number of committees, the number of stops that committees have to go to. But it seems to me, I'd just like to see what you think it is, and I know that you make your living by accommodating, not antagonizing legislators. So since there's committee chairs in the room, I don't want to put you on the spot too much. But my observation has been that there are sometimes, particularly given how many committees we have, when there's some committee chairs who ask to see a bill when they really, really don't need to. And I'll give an extreme example where maybe you've got 30 terms in a bill that have nothing to do with the environment, but one of the terms in the list of 30 is the term trees. And then you see the chair, and this is just a hypothetical, I'm not taking on any particular chair. This didn't happen to me, disclaimer. But I'm just pulling an example out of thin air. But you might see in that circumstance the chair of an environment committee saying, well, I got to see that bill, it says trees. And it's another stop in the process. And that's kind of an over-the-top example. But do you think there might, without naming names or specific people, do you think there might be instances where really committee chairs can maybe accommodate the process by saying, gee, you know, I really don't need to hear this. It says trees, but this really isn't an environmental bill, and I don't really need to hear this. I mean, Representative Pawlowski, for example, he has to hear bills that involve rulemaking. He has no choice in the matter. So for some committees, there isn't any discretion there. But for the committee chairs where there is discretion, do you think that might help?
Right.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, I think one of the things, and I'll give Mr. Melander a copy of my testimony if you have it, would be to put in a better list of or better process for which statutes are required to go through which committees, which might alleviate some of that subjectivity that committee chairs have. So you know, for example, if you're amending this statute, it's got to go to this committee. If you're not amending the statute, well, then there may not be a reason to go to this committee. I would say that, for instances where you have a committee chairperson who either wants to or doesn't want to hear a bill that maybe fall inside those guidelines, that would be what a committee on re-referral would deal with. So you've got a few members of the body rather than just the committee chair making that decision for them. But I think the Senate in general, at least I know when I've tried to get bills either moved someplace or not moved someplace, have told me, no, it's got to go here, or it doesn't have to go here because of the statute of impact. So I think a better understanding of those rules might alleviate a lot of those situations.
Mr. Barshwartz and Simon, in reference to this committee, in the rules, there's a rather detailed delineation of what goes to this committee. It isn't necessarily by statute, but it is much more detailed than most of the other committees. So you raise an excellent point. And in rules, if it were by statute or if it were by some other type of delineation, it would make it clear what could or should go to another committee. I have Representative Kalin next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to piggyback off of what Representative Simon brought up, the first part of the questions, which was the suggestion, kind of a caution against changes setting up a process essentially where a single filibuster, a single roadblock could prevent a bill from being progressed at all. Your suggestion on fiscal note that budget impact bills, whether it's an omnibus bill or a single bill, not be able to proceed without a fiscal note. I just wanted to point out that my hackles were raised by that thought that the administration not liking a bill could essentially do death by lack of fiscal note. And so I think we need to, and I imagine that it would work both ways in terms of partisans in power. We haven't had a DFL governor for 2 decades, so we don't know, but I imagine that it would work that way as well. So that's just a caution. But then to a totally separate subject, I've noticed that or observed that a lot of the pressure on lack of notice of committees, and I've been as frustrated as you, I think that the more transparent can be, the better. A lot of that pressure over lack of notice and bills being put out for public notice 3 hours before they're heard, which in my mind is really unacceptable, comes from having no bill introduction deadline, but an early policy deadline. And I know it's this, each of the first 2 years that I've been here, that not only pushing the policy deadline out, but perhaps even introducing a hard bill introduction deadline, even if it's only for that policy deadline, that could be a week or 2 weeks earlier. So that, you know, the committee, the deadline might be a Friday, and so the committee staff might be, and chair might be able to take a breather on that next Monday or Tuesday and say, okay, and sit down with the bills that have been referred to that committee that have not yet been heard, and kind of lay things out, so then you have time for the notice of amendments, you have time for notice of hearing, and you don't have folks introducing a bill Thursday so it can be heard Friday, and you don't have these quadruple X bills. I'm just wondering if you think that that model could work, or if you have some other feedback for introducing it that way.
Mr. Parsh. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, I think you can put timelines in place, whether it's in the bill introduction process or in the hearing notice process, to make sure the public has the ability to review a piece of legislation. While personally I'm sure many of my members would love to actually limit the number of bill introductions, I don't know that an organization that is promoting the representation and the petition of government, we want to get in that situation, because we have many, many members, myself included often, who have a number of bills we want to introduce. So perhaps rather than putting limits on when bills can be introduced, I think your suggestion was more along the lines of making sure that before a bill is added to a committee hearing agenda, it's been introduced ahead of time so the language is available. And then if you've got the agenda set at a certain time frame ahead, then the public should have the opportunity to be able to review that legislation. And I hope that answer makes sense.
Representative Taylor.
I think it does and it doesn't. I mean, I think it puts more ideas on the table, which is really helpful at this point. I think the thought was that if you do have a hard bill introduction deadline, that then any bill that's introduced after that is introduced for public vetting, but not, it can't be heard. It can't be, I mean, you could obviously try to find a way to amend it, but onto an existing bill, but I think that amendment would then be subject to the same transparency and public notice, and that I think having some way for this rush that happens at the end, you know, where bills are being heard before they're introduced and then, you know, get an informal hearing and then they get stamped on their way out. You'll hear a lot of support. I think there were a lot of us murmuring on this notion of real strict identification of jurisdiction of committees by statute even. I think that one caution that I would have is to leave open interpretation for overlapping jurisdictions. But I'd like to talk more informally also about some other design for the bill introduction deadline and the policy hearing deadline. One last thought, Mr. Chair, or observation, is that I think we need a clearer delineation of what's a policy bill and what's a finance bill. I carried a bill that surprised me by it making finance deadlines, even though it was entirely policy reform of the design build contracts. And so it wasn't settled out until the last day of session and got caught up in all other sorts of politics and never became law, when I believed that it was actually a policy bill, but everyone else seemed to be acting as if it was quite different. And so I think we need much more clarification on how that works, so that the I think actually delaying action ends up killing bills, because they get caught up in that whirlpool rather than having a fair and open hearing early enough to advance.
Mr. Marsh, you want to respond? Or?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kalin, I'd agree with you. I think if you've got a little small piece of legislation that doesn't do a whole lot, you got to work really hard to get that taken care of right away, because you do run out of time. And if it doesn't rise to the importance of some of the other major pieces of legislation, it does get caught in that whirlwind. On your idea of bill introductions or having a timeline by when bills need to be introduced before they can be considered to meet a committee deadline, again, I think, deadlines are great and would help the process so long as those deadlines are enforced. And again, as long as that also wouldn't preclude someone from introducing a piece of legislation throughout the process, which I think is something that we wouldn't want to hinder someone from introducing a bill.
Representative Todd.
Mr. Chairman and members, I guess I particularly want to follow up on some of the things that Jeremy said, but one of the things where I kind of wrote the most nose over on this was the idea of the limit of bill introduction. But the things, because I put in at least five bills at the end, of which were put in only to make sure that they got public vetting before the next session and got interest. And all of them are ones which are controversial, and actually I've had conversations with people on a national level on the bills. And I used one of them as a postscript on a wedding invitation for a wedding I went to yesterday, which was not. But anyway, but what I really agree with is the point that Representative Kalin made, is the idea of if there's a deadline for introduction of bills where you expect a committee hearing for that year, I think is really very reasonable. I think that that's very different than a total introduction, than a total limit on bill hearing. And I also, I'm not sure whether I mentioned this or not at the old ones, at the last meeting, is that we have a whole bunch of bills introduced that really don't have a lot of, well, one that's new. It's only been new in this session, or maybe this session, that every time if you wanted to have a capital investment issue heard, you had to introduce it as a bill, which is usually just a one line for an appropriation. I think one could have an official item, which is a capital investment agenda, which could just be the items that are going to be heard by capital investment, and you could have some official way of adding to that agenda without putting in a bill. And then the items on that agenda could go to the possible policy committee. I mean, these are just things that in no way are ever going to end up as a separate bill, and why don't we recognize that from the start and start it. The other item, which is allowing a larger number of authors on bill as a way of reducing the numbers of bills introduced, I think that that number of 35 was chosen because it was the one that fit on a second green seat. And I don't know if the and I don't know if there's any reason not to have a third green seat or fourth green seat or something like that. But I think there would be good reason not to just automatically produce them for every, you know, we actually produce that second seat for every bill. And maybe there would be, and I guess I just don't know what causes more trouble, you know, to just automatically have that extra piece of paper on every bill, or to just add the number that you want when they're when you expect them.
So, okay, thanks. Representative Wofford is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Barth. I appreciate many of your comments and agree with many of them. I'd like to hear a little more about, and if you're not prepared to address this now and in the future, the role of MDRC in sort of mediating the expectations of your members and your clients on the number of bills or the likelihood of consideration, because I think we're all wrestling with the issue of, you know, there's a million ideas in the universe and maybe they don't all deserve the same equal amount of time and attention or action in a particular session, and yet we all have experienced, I think, the encounter with the panicked lobbyist who feels that they're going to lose a client or their job or whatever if something doesn't get through, and it might be very important to a small subset that they represent, but in the bigger picture of what we're dealing with, it's not. And I think there's some obligation on our part to set the agenda, but I think also the expectation of the groups that come forward to be able to say to their clients, you know, I think it's reasonable for us to think we can get one or two things through this session, but your list of 20 dreams, maybe that's a long-term plan. And I think that there's an obligation. I mean, we have to do that individually. Our constituents might have 100 ideas as well, and we know we're not going to get 100 bills through, and we have to play that same process. But if you've got any ideas on how your organization might assist us in that, And one idea I wanted to throw out, and it's one that I had seen used effectively long ago when I was working in state education policy, in which policy committees actually set an agenda years in advance and said so that every area of their jurisdiction got attention. And in education, in those days, the Senate and the House would agree on two issues for interim study. And it might be the Senate's going to look at school transportation and the House is going to look at school lunch funding and programs and issues. And the next year we're going to look at community education and, you know, something else. And so they kind of teed up issues. And they actually, as a policy committee, then spent time looking at nationally what was being done in that area, what was just getting input from local school districts and superintendents and teachers and parents about those issues. And it was a way to sort of not have those issues come up every year, but rather have a clustering. And so I'd be interested in whether you think something like that might work in some other areas, to just sort of say that we regularly are doing some oversight in some major areas, but also we kind of cluster the policy development in those areas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I think any structure that's set by a committee, whether it's timelines and what they can hear and what they can't hear, or maybe a less formal structure that they set about here's the agendas or the issues we're going to discuss this year and hope to take action on. I think any of those, if they're held to, set the expectation in the public that here's what's achievable, here's what's not achievable, which in turn I would hope would trickle down to the fact that myself and the rest of our members are placing reasonable expectation with their clients about what they can and cannot affect throughout the process. To your point about how do we encourage them to do that, I'd say we'd love to work with you on setting that a structure or process so that it's known, real, you know, here are the expectations, here's the work the committee might be doing, or here's the schedule the committee has and they're going to stick to it. I would hope that if we follow that process, it would just become a reality that there aren't groups who think that they can get a zillion things passed because they've got the entire legislative session to try to stick and hide and put things anywhere they can in an effort to get them passed. I do want to be hesitant, though, about whether it's our group or the public or legislators, for that matter, being felt like they're told they don't have the opportunity to introduce or have their ideas heard. I don't think we want to get down the road, and I don't think that's what you're suggesting, but I think if we put the structure in place, it might let everyone have a better idea of what those expectations are.
Representative Loeffler, there was a time when the House did have mini-sessions, and those mini-sessions went to various areas of the state, and all committees then would hear issues, whether it was southeastern Minnesota or western Minnesota or northeastern. And I do note that Representative Greiling's here. Her committee has already posted a series of hearings that are, they're not here. They're actually, I think, in various areas of the state. Note that this hearing is the result of something that happened starting in June of 2007, and that we began this process actually last year in order to have a series of hearings once we got past bill deadline, so we didn't clutter bill deadline, with the anticipation that those hearings would go over the interim and that we would have a recommendation for 2009. It can be done, but your point, I think, is a good one. It takes planning, and it takes planning in advance and then sticking to it and not being sidetracked. So there are big issues. Representative Greiling has one of the larger issues, education finance, which if she resolves that one, it will be historic and transparent and benchmark. Any other word or phrase we can apply to it. So, yeah, miracle is the other one, I guess, we're applying to. Representative Walker, any other? Do you have another question? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to what Representative Kalin had suggested as far as having a hard set introductory deadline for that, I'm just curious if that would include fixes to bills, because I think that this year we had a transportation policy fix that we had to do. Would that exclude them from that deadline, or would that deadline apply to things like that? I'm just trying to kind of get a feel for what your thoughts were.
Representative Kale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson. I guess we'd have to think a little bit more thoroughly about how that might work. I would hope that that would be the sort of thing that could be done by amending on another bill or finding. I mean, you could always do. I don't know. I think we'd have to think about it. There's a danger of loopholes for a delete all amendment that then just has to go through, say, a 48-hour posting transparency process or something like that. I think we would just. I actually think that having the deadlines and having more space and more time for consideration would likely prevent those sorts of drafting errors or troubles. I mean, like we saw in the I believe it was the budget bill or the tax bill. I think it was the tax bill. So we have the two provisions we have to clean up. So I think that more transparency and more deadlines and more time for all of us to read through things, especially staff, for them not to be so rushed. I think the goal is to prevent those that need.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Representative.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. And then I was hoping, Mr. Chair, you could help me out with something a little bit. Looking at D on the scheduling/agenda of committees, I don't know if this was an actual written rule or if this was just common courtesy that was done in the past. I remember when I first came here to the legislature, it seemed that every Thursday evening we would get a schedule for the following week of everything that the committees were going to be hearing. And it was great because you could plan out your week for whatever member you were working for. And then it was also, you were guaranteed, I think it was, I don't know if it was 2 days or it was just 1 day notice that we would give, if there were changes to that agenda, that you would get every night. You would get this it was a paper version. We didn't have the email capabilities back then. Was that a written rule or was that just kind of a common courtesy that we had in place? And I'm just kind of relying on your knowledge of the
past. First, I'm going to see if Mr. Shepard recalls.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, my recollection is that was more of an informal custom and practice. I don't recall that as a written rule.
Okay.
But since you brought it up, it sounds like a good idea.
It was very it was helpful.
So you said it was on Thursday evening.
And we did it Thursday evening because back then a lot of Greater Minnesota legislators would leave Thursday night to go home. And so it made sure that the assistants had that information. They put it in their spindle so they knew what their week would look like the next week. And then if there were any changes to the agenda as things happened, you were always guaranteed that it was at least, if it wasn't 48 hours, it was at least 24-hour notice of changes to the agenda. It wasn't any, you never saw TBD to be determined on an agenda.
Representative Anderson, my recollection is too that there were almost no hearings on Fridays. Fridays was a fairly open day, and you went back to district, and if there was anything going on, it was an in-district item. And
either in-district or if you had office work here at the Capitol. Yep.
And the same held true for Monday morning. Monday morning was more of a noon, started at noon, and you didn't have then the weight of having hearings on Friday and then a hearing early Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a suggestion, actually, that's come through several of the emails that members have suggested to us about having to be here for hearings on Friday and then on Monday. And if you're Greater Minnesota, it almost makes the weekend impossible to do anything because you're in transit. So that's another good point. Representative Anderson, did you have anything else? I've got Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Burke, if you have some comments on this, I'd appreciate that. But this is just something I'd like to reflect on and give comment to and see what members have to say. I've appreciated Representative Kahn's persistence with addressing the concerns inherent to limiting bill introductions. And now Representative Kalin's highlighted the idea of addressing that by bill introduction deadline, but still allow bill introductions following that, which I think is a very good idea. The point, I have a kind of an outline here, and the point I'd like to point out with this, the point that I'd like to address with this outline is that wherever we have an unregulated or underregulated process or regulations that stifle the will of the body, or say even the will of the majority or minority in the body, we then seem to run into problems. So if we have bill introduction deadlines, but no limits with a process by the body to hear a bill if they see a bill that they'd like heard, so they could be overridden by the body, and then a bill hearing deadline, and then a committee passage deadline, we bring bills into committee, and we feel, well, this isn't controversial at all. So we go to put it on the consent calendar. The body can take it off the consent calendar very easily. Well, we very often also see bills in committee that are very controversial, and we don't have a controversial calendar. We don't flag it as controversial, and many of us leave, well, maybe I shouldn't say this, many of us leave committee saying, wow, there's a lot of amendments for that bill. We'll do it on the floor because there isn't another opportunity in committee. And even if there is, we're not on the committee where it's coming up, and we don't have time to organize the effort to bring the amendments forward on the other committees that it'll be heard on. Now, sometimes that's done naturally for political reasons, but sometimes it's absolutely out of our control. So when we have a bill in committee and we know it's controversial, if we actually flag it as controversial, hold the bill up for a day, give it more time for public airing, so everybody anticipates the next day it comes up in committee, that's when we're going to do all the amendments. That's when they'll be really aired out for the interest groups and the citizens of the state to testify on those. And when a bill goes through that process, given that it's been flagged as such, any amendments on the floor would not be permissible unless they've been heard in committee. I'm going to bring an idea in that I suggested at the last hearing that I said at that time I wouldn't support, but I'm starting to see a way that maybe we could fine-tune it so it would be legitimately possible to support with respect for every member of the body. If in that scenario a bill did not have a amendment presented in committee, the body could then say this amendment's out of order. It would have to go back to committee to be heard because we've given it more time in committee. Lastly, at the end of the process, the House and Senate floor deadline with a general orders process, again, a two-step process, and then conference committee deadline. The under-regulation on the beginning and the end is where we seem to run into problems. The beginning with bill introductions, piling up days, bills introduced days before committee deadline, we're still trying to get them heard. In the end, bills being passed, and there isn't even time for conference committees. The under-regulation on the beginning and the end is where we seem to have most of the problems. And I think there's a lot we could do, and I too appreciate all this discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and As Representative Olson said, I appreciate the conversation we're having here, and I don't want to. My suggestion here is not to try to limit the debate or cut anybody off in airing their concerns about whatever recommendations we might make. But people have expressed concerns about enacting or recommending the enaction of rules that might create an issue, perhaps. As we move on into the future, and my understanding, and I've seen it happen on the floor, is we already do have a process by suspending the rules. We've declared urgencies. We declared an urgency with the flood relief bill in the special session. I remember with a Representative Holberg bill, we declared an urgency on an issue relating to athletic eligibility of a student. And we acted on that bill in an urgent fashion. So I believe there is precedent for declaring an urgency when there is general consensus amongst the body, as Representative Olson has continues to keep us focused on the ability of the body to act. So I think we do have in rules already, an opportunity to suspend whatever rules we may recommend be enacted for helping the legislative process in those rare situations where we do all agree that, hey, this is an issue that needs to be dealt with urgently, or this is something that has come up since the deadline that we've imposed. We do need to deal with this urgently. We do need to deal with this in spite of those deadlines. So I would just recommend that we consider that as a way to deal with some of the problems that our recommendations may possibly perhaps create in the future.
Representative Cox.
Chairman and members, I'll point out that always with the deadlines we have too, there is always an exceptional path, and that's through the Rules Committee. And there's no reason that wouldn't be kept with any deadline that we that we put in. For example, if a bridge happened to collapse on May 10th instead of August 1st, I think we'd really want to be able to deal with it. And I think the critical thing is that the Rules Committee needs to take that. And I think it does. I don't think there are many bills that ask to get the exception through the Rules Committee. And several of them, including one where I sit on the committee and then the conference committee, is assumed at the beginning of the session that that will happen, and that's the pension bill. Just because it's an issue that only a handful of people are interested in, so it's a committee that doesn't have a regularly scheduled time, and so it's very hard to get the attendance that you need until the committee deadlines are passed.
Just a comment, not a question.
Representative Hines, do something else?
No.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've taken some notes here, I think. I just need to provide some observations. It seems as though we really do like to listen to ourselves talk, and I also think apparently we also like to listen to ourselves think. And I'm just wondering if we ever get to a point where we actually will act. and I fully appreciate that the chair has said that he wants to define the process and adequately discuss the potential outcome, but I really do fear death by discussion. And I'm wondering, I guess, I think it's just my own personality that I'm very much a task-oriented person, and I really am maybe just a linear thinker, and people are too complex thinking here for me, but I'm just wondering... I'm a bit concerned because I'm very excited about this topic. I think that it really fits well for what we want to do and to get to a point where we can make some structural changes that will be beneficial to ourselves as well as to the public. And so I'm a little, going to be a mouse in the corner squeaking a little bit perhaps about how we're going to get to the next steps and how we're going to make some things happen. And as we started this process, I thought this will be a great summer, maybe early fall project, and we'll work on it, and we'll come together, and we'll come up with something. And now I'm fearful that we won't finish before Christmas. And I'm a little, I wanted to comment on that. I think on the committees, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was just the frustration I had from last year, and maybe that segues into something else, but... Last year, I know that there was a lot of committees that met, there were subcommittees that met, there were working groups that met, there were a lot of people that got together on a fairly regular basis to perhaps talk and think. I'm not sure how much to act, but as a person who works outside of the legislature, I actually have another job, I find it somewhat difficult sometimes to be able to travel the distance and participate. And so I just wanted to make that comment as we're looking at the interim committee meetings as well. I appreciate this one because I have an interest in it and I want to be able to more fully serve and participate. But that was just something I noticed last year, and I didn't want to get to the point where we have two legislative bodies within the legislature house to those that can participate and those that can't. And those are just my observations and comments, and I would just appreciate maybe a little bit of an understanding of where we're hoping to go from here.
Okay. Representative Poppy, you make a good point, and I'm going to make a couple of announcements to that. We're trying to keep these hearings close enough together so that people remember what we did in the previous hearing. And the tentative date for the next meeting is July 10th. We have the holidays, and there's no way we're going to do anything over the fourth week. That's just too much going on. July 10th is a reasonable date for our next meeting, and again, it would be in the morning. That seems possible. July 10th. It would be a Thursday. Be a little later in the week, but again, we have the holidays, and because of the holidays, it makes it difficult. And then I want to go over Representative Poppy's other point, which is an excellent one, because I've already alluded to it. We've been at this for a while, over a year and a half, actually, when you take a look at when we started. Our goal is to do at the next meeting, if you have your original legislative process outline, we would do page 3, floor procedures would be the next meeting. So between today and July 10th, your recommendations on floor procedures for comments on that. And that is a rather large one, and it is somewhat controversial. I want to remind everyone that because all these areas are interrelated, it's impossible to come to a conclusion as we go past each step. We really need to go through all of these, and then once we've done going through all of them, come to some joint conclusions. And Representative Peterson, I think at the last meeting, got us started in the right track by saying we needed to go point by point, and that was an excellent observation, and we're going to follow it. So until we're done looking at all of these areas, we really can't make conclusions, because the conclusions that we're going to make are interrelated. It's difficult to say that if you do one thing, it doesn't impact something else. I'm hoping we'll be done by the end of the summer. That was my goal. That by the end of the summer, into the fall, we would be done, and then however the elections came out, there would be recommendations for whoever took over the House. I'm more concerned about the House right now than the joint rules. We can't control the Senate, and the governor's office, we all know. That's even more difficult. But the House is ours. So if that is a partial answer to Representative Poppe's question, and it is important we have members here. The other thing is these are all being televised. So they may not be televised live, but they are being televised delayed. So whatever we're doing here, the rest of the state will be taking a look at. So Representative Poppe, does that address your first concern? Representative Grouse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am sympathetic to that as well, and I will not be able to attend all of them, and I don't serve on this committee, but I'm, like everybody else, delighted that we're doing this. And I am particularly at this meeting because of the topic being committees, and I want to underscore that, you know, it's my opinion that the biggest problem is the number of committees more than it is the committee process. And I think we have talked a lot about the committee process, and I don't disagree that that could use some addressing, too. But I think a lot of the problems would somewhat dissolve if we had less committees. And the Friday problem of committees meeting, the Monday morning problem of committees meeting, you know, people trying to track things. I think Mr. Barsh did a nice job of laying out the problems for the lobbyists and who represent the public and the public to figure out what we're doing when we have so many committees. And we all know that the number of committees is very political. You know, people want to be chairs, and if you're going to have one class be a chair, then you have the whole class be a chair, and so forth. So I think a very strong recommendation from this committee on the committee structure, you know, doing as best we can with matching with the Senate, would be a finite thing that could really cut to the chase on a lot of the problems that we have. And I want to then conclude, Mr. Chair, by asking for some discussion and perhaps some input from our testifier on page 2. It's under section A, number 4. And this is one, I don't know, Mr. Chair, if Representative Peterson has had a chance to give you input on this or not, but he and I discussed the mental health division a couple of days ago, and trying to decide, you know, where something like that fits in and what we would recommend to leadership and to this committee. And because it does not do what number 4 says, provides that the subcommittee will consist primarily or entirely of members of the parent committee. You know, right now the mental health division feeds into Representative Peterson's committee, a policy committee, and then it feeds into the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. But yet, the members were made up of a variety of committees, such as Representative Paymar asked to be on it because mental health is covered in judiciary. That's where we do a lot of mental health cares, in the prisons and jails. Of course, it is Health and Human Services. I was on it because it's in Human Services. I was on it because it goes into education a little bit. It covers employment is a topic, housing is a topic, and we discussed, you know, this point that maybe that committee, if there is such a committee, should not be an actual division of Health and Human Services policy, but rather kind of an ad hoc committee that would kind of be an umbrella for that group, but would be one or two members from Judiciary, Health and Human Services, Housing, Representative Rucamina's Employment Committee, and the Education Committee. And then that would get rid of one committee, and it wouldn't have to feed into just one of the five prongs that that committee covers. But yet it would be some new thing that could be considered. So I wanted to put that into your thinking cap for
a possible way to have one less committee, but yet have some work that would be overseeing a larger topic within many committees. In other words, it would be cross-jurisdictional, and I don't see that on this point, any on this handout any place, and I would like some input from Mr. Barsh. The people that lobby for mental health have been very appreciative of that committee, that, you know, it's all in one place, and they can hear, see it comprehensively discussed, but yet when it, you know, after a certain point in the session, it's gone, and that committee doesn't really oversee it anymore. So it isn't working well at the end of session like it does at the beginning.
Mr. Barsh.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grayling, I think, speaking generally on the topic of subcommittees, I do think it makes sense to have the subcommittees made up of members of the full committee if we expect that subcommittee to be taking action on specific pieces of pieces of legislation. And I think the idea of a subcommittee is that they would vet or view specific topics, and then once their recommendations got to the full committee, they would be acted upon. I think the issue we're having now with so many subcommittees is they are just acting as a separate body or committee to meet, and once it gets to the full committee, it's redebated and rediscussed. And I think one of the reasons is it's the subcommittees aren't always made up of the members of that committee. So I think the recommendation number four that you pointed out would be a good one if we expect and require subcommittees to act like a full committee. And I think your recommendation on the mental health subcommittee is one that probably could be followed in other areas where you have a group of legislators who may have overlapping either jurisdiction or interest in issue meeting to discuss that issues, but that they are not taking formal action on those pieces of legislation. So a mental health bill would not have to go through the subcommittee, would still need to go through all of its steps, but there would be an informal group for all the interested parties to get a breakdown of. I think that could help alleviate some of the pressure to hear so many bills by such a certain timeline.
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy had brought this point up, I think, earlier in the meeting about a better delineation of the committee structure, and I think it was Representative Murphy that had made a tentative request to Mr. Barsh about your organization doing their version of a committee structure. And I think it would be interesting if you would do it and then provide us with what you would see as a committee structure that would work with the House and the Senate in a way that would be more productive. Representative Greiling's point about subcommittees is well taken, but I'd extend it even to working groups and listening groups. I think we've gotten very sloppy with what these things do. And if they are committees, then they should have the responsibility of their actions. And that's why we're doing this in a standing committee, and it's being recorded, and hopefully the result will show the work of this committee. And we're inviting any member of the House to join us. And I really appreciate other members taking time to come and sit in on the committee. You'll be treated just like a regular committee member. So if you have a comment or a suggestion, it will be recorded and used. Representative Grayling, do you have another point that you wanted to make?
No, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get that a new idea out there, which is not on this list, but
okay.
I do think less committees in general would solve a lot of problems.
I've got a working list here, so I'm going to go down. Representative Portman is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had kind of a comment and then a question. We have kind of a culture here of amending things that we don't like rather than just voting no. Sometimes knowing full well that if all 72 of the amendments you draft to the bill were passed and added on to it, you'd still vote no on the bill. And I think that there's a difficult question of how to change the culture to be one where you can disagree, you can give a fantastic speech that really communicates why it's such a bad bill without spending the reviser time and energy, the floor staff time and energy to deal with multiple amendments. And I drafted some suggested rule changes last week, and they didn't really pertain to committee, so that's probably why we're not talking about them today. But we keep getting back to this tension between controlling the process so that it's more reasonable for the public and it's more reasonable in terms of time that it takes, and the other value that we all want, which is free speech, and every member has an unlimited ability to provide input. And I think that those two are not mutually exclusive when you look at limits to bill introductions by members, or a time limit on filing amendments before committee, or a time limit on filing amendments before you get to the floor. I think that we're forgetting that there's an unlimited amount of time that a member could have a press conference. It doesn't require the reviser to draft 72 amendments. You have an unlimited of time, amount of time. You can have town hall meetings. You can go to people's doors. You can call radio stations. So there are other ways for members to have their voice heard other than via an amendment in committee or an amendment on the floor. So, or introduction of a bill. So I just want to keep going back to the point that I am a proponent of limiting time on debate on the floor and limiting bill introductions, not sharply, not restrictively, but and also respecting very much that members have the right to have their opinions heard and have their voice heard. But I have a question that I think in committees it might be reasonable to propose at least an hour before committee that an amendment be on the internet, so that, because I think it is a real problem that the public doesn't have access. I think it's a real problem on the floor and in committee, but the problem, we do want to have flexibility so that if, you know, you're going up to your committee hearing and that's when the pressure point comes and different sides of the issue start to make some progress, you know, they might not be to peace, love, and happiness, but that are making some changes, everybody agrees are intelligent. You want the flexibility to be able to do that short period of time before the hearing, but even an hour or 2 hours before the hearing, I think it would be constructive to have an amendment up on a website, and that I don't think it's hard to do. And I wondered if that was, what I liked was Representative Simon's idea that you have like a 12-hour rule for most amendments, or 24, 48, but you have a different, shorter rule for the chief author, and that would be maybe 4 hours before the hearing or 1 hour before the hearing if you get something on the internet. And I just wondered if you had a reaction to that idea.
Mr. Barsh.
Mrs. Chairman, President Ortman, I think, again, I think any structure where you're putting advanced requirements for notice of amendments out there is a step in the right direction. You know, there's a 24-hour rule in the House, or there isn't, kind of depending on what bill and what committee or what's happening. And I think, you know, how and when that rule is enforced versus when it's not leads to some of the problems. But I think if there's requirements that amendments are, you know, submitted 24 hours in advance, publicly available in advance, that can only help. Quite frankly, it probably makes it real, well, requires me and the rest of our members to get our act in order too. Which would help you out. But then clearly there would have to be an exception. I mean, oral amendments are made, technical amendments are made in committees when issues are right. You know, if there's a compromise that's created, you know, you'd want that exception to be allowed either through the delay of the hearing on that bill or either by the consensus of the committee through some formal action. But clearly there has to be some exception made for issues that arise, either positive or negative.
Representative Harmon.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment that I thought Representative Anderson's idea of having the next week's schedule completed by Thursday evening is reasonable and something I would really like for us to be able to accomplish. I really like that idea.
I think there's a growing support for that. I have a list, but we do have one other individual who wishes to testify. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Jack Davies, former state senator. That might mean relevance in at this meeting. I am just delighted with the list of goals and thoughts that were represented in the two documents that were delivered to the committee. I'll give them a blanket endorsement, even though I have a little nitpicking on two or three of them, but I want to get one other thing on the agenda and the of this committee, and the problem is I'm going to be making a tour of North Dakota at your next meeting, so I can't do that. I made a mistake 37 years ago.
Takes a long time, or I'm sorry.
I know. I'm sure what you said was very good.
You do know how to present.
I am absolutely. Yeah, on my honor, I'm going to be in North Dakota the day of your next meeting.
Mr. Jennings, it will be recorded, so you can get it online.
Okay. But I can't input, and what I'd like to do now, Chairman, is input. I made a mistake 37 years ago when we were writing the annual session amendment. The story is this, that there was a provision in the Constitution at the time that said that the legislature can meet for 120 days. Decided when we went, and that was the limit on a single year session. So we thought, as we did the annual session amendment, that if we took that out, that some demagogue would grab that removing of that 120 days and kill the annual session amendment, which we were desperate to get passed. So we said, well, let's leave it in there, and we'll add a sentence that says a legislative day may be defined by law. So the amendment was adopted, and then it came the beginning of the next session, and we started figuring out, well, how can we work that loophole that we'd written in? And there was no way to get around the 120-day provision. So that is why you're meeting twice a week for weeks. And that's why the bills say House File XXX, because the author of the bill was unable to put the bill in, get it received by the House, and a number put on it. And that's why committee reports, one committee can't act on a bill because the committee report referring it to that committee has not gone to the House because there's been no House session. It's just a pointless limitation. Now, if you're worried about having to walk over to the House chamber too often, you can have both sessions where two or three people show up, and all they do is receive committee reports and bill introductions, re-referrals, and whatever else business has to be done. The a statement of the question on the amendment is I've had it proposed for a number of years, but I've never had a young tiger as author. I've always gone to the leadership and always had the leadership, but then they never pass it. So I'm looking for mean young legislators to be authors of this bill in the next session. This is what the question is. Shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to speed legislative work by removing the limit on how many days the House and Senate may meet in official floor session, retaining the present January to May limit on the length of legislative sessions? And it will pass if you'll submit it, and you won't have to get to, what did you get to this year, 119 or 120 legislative days? You certainly, I've not looked it up, but it was one of those 2 days. And you certainly would have wanted to work or to meet on the floor session some additional days had it not been for this stupid constitutional provision that I'm responsible for. I don't think I need any questions. It's not the only mistake I made, Mr. Chairman. But thank you for your attention.
Senator Davies, thank you. And remind the committee, too, that Senator Davies is also a judge. Mm-hmm. So he served in two capacities. Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Judge Davies, I want to remind you that you're not, you don't have to bear sole blame. The majority of the electorate also did approve that constitutional amendment. So
we have one individual. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman,
please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. As most of you know, I've been a part of this process for 3 decades, plus 1 year now, as we get into next year. And I'm someone that has done this just basically as a citizen, I just want to share with you some good points on some things I'd like to share with you. One point is, if you as legislators have never read it, it's some dry reading, but it's a fantastic book. It's Jack Davies' Legislative Process in a Nutshell. I read it decades ago, and it's still a guiding principle how I, as a citizen, understand the process. So I don't know if any of you have read that or whatever, and it's a pretty neat book. So I'd like to encourage you just to refresh or whatever.
Mister, we do have a couple of copies of it. Senator Davies was already had delivered two copies to the chair and to the committee administrator when we started this process. So if any member wants one, we've got a couple of them. But I do recommend buying it.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, my second point is, as you start to develop these guidelines or as they become rules, you have to think on the other side of the eight ball is how does it affect the public and the public perception? And how then is the public going to adapt to these rules? Not just, you know, the paid folks, but the regular folks, the citizens, and all those that come down here a lot on specific issues, not someone like myself who's consistently here. And there's some citizens like that. So when you come up with your final recommendations, you might want to have a little part or a little section that says, well, how are these going to be implemented for the public to know, to find out? One of the things that, because I visit an NCSL site and all that other on topics, but and just on other issues too. But the thing is, oh, it's the internet. It's still paper for a lot of folks. And so, and also, even an organizational way of how their house information is separate from the clerk's office. And how if I want something to know about a bill or whatever, they'll say, well, call house information. While in the Senate, they're basically together, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm just sharing with you, you know, some things that you can do to get things out and information out to the public. The points that I want to make up or talk about are some of the as on your June 23rd memo. You've already talked about mental health. In the 30 years plus that I've been here now, data practices / privacy / freedom of information laws are ones that are a specialized kind of thing. And what happens in a lot of these situations, you have where in one year there might not be a subcommittee, another year there might be a subcommittee for 3 years, might be a full committee or whatever, a standing committee or whatever. And what has happened, and that's not just that issue, but there's other issues too that have become a constant thing and just need a lot of attention. And so I think that's important to have some type of specialized standing committee. And I think other than just members from that committee, because those kinds of issues spread across the spectrum. The thing that I would like to also encourage is that when you say allow bills to be considered, this is on page 2, simultaneously by multiple committees, again, I'm looking at it from a citizen's perspective. It's kind of hard all of a sudden, well, this bill is going to deal with this. This bill is going to be going to this committee because data practices, but the main topic of that bill where data practices involved, you know, they affect the vote. So that will happen in those kinds of situations, depending on the bill. So you could that I've seen to where there's this informalness kind of thing, and then there are some points of view that are raised in the informality of hearing a bill, but the informality that never gets over to the committee process. Another item is, even though I am very much an open government person and all that. But I know at least the process about where you set a limit of where amendments can be done, 24 hours, 48 hours, and then no amendments can be entertained by the committee, I think without some flexibility hurts the process. I can only say for my own self, and I know that there's some other citizen groups and things like that, that at, over a period of years there has been a strong enforcement of that rule. And then what happens, the citizen or whatever, I know I have, but I have time to do other things, but there has to be some flexibility there. I think it's important to get that out, to get it, but you've got to have that flexibility because it's the testimony. A citizen can testify at a committee hearing who just comes out of the woodwork, which sometimes Neumeister does and others, brings up a point of view and then offer, you know, I know some people, but sometimes I don't have a chance to get to a committee person. A lot of citizens don't. But then you might offer
a principled amendment in own language, and then it's done around or worked on. So I think you don't want to put yourself in a box in that regard to where the citizens are able to do some things. And the bottom line on the third point is conference committees. One of the things that has happened, at least with the issue that I've focused a lot on over the years, is that it doesn't get heard in a jurisdictional committee, and all of a sudden it ends up in a conference committee, and then trying to talk to those five conference people on either side who don't know a hell of a bean sometimes about the concept of data practices or privacy or whatever, because they're not interested in that. Try and show them the positives and the weaknesses or whatever of that particular position is kind of hard. So I've just seen that. That was one of the items, at least with Mr. Thiessen's medical records law about privacy. On the Senate side, didn't even get the policy that was brought in from the House. And then the Senate social service people, well, you know, something clean about privacy, but it's kind of up in daisies on it. I mean, they didn't know a lot. And it was also like that with other kinds of data practices situations over the years. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my points, and I would like to thank you very much for at least entertaining a few comments for myself.
Mr. Newman, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Newman? No? And I still have a list I'm working off of. Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I came to this world, the legislature, it was the first time in my life that I came into a world where finance and policy were separated. I've come from a world where eventually everything is where the dollar is. It all ends there. And I jokingly tell people, even the legislature, at the end of the day, it's all about dollars. And so I guess I would be curious when Mr. Bartis talked about adding another item to the list of memos today was the subject of finance committees and the fact that the fiscal implications need to be understood by the finance committees before it got out of there. That raises the question, I'd be interested in his comments, and then when he looks at possibly drafting some suggestions of looking, why do we separate the finance committees and the policy? Now, I'm walking into storm here because I know I've got two committee chairs who committee operation, government finance and education finance and transportation finance, and yet they're separate from education policy and government policy. How did it happen? Why does it happen? And is that the right way? And I would just be interested if you come back with a paper, would you be willing to address that issue? Why have we separated them? What's happening here? And maybe, Mr. Chairman, you have some.
Well, Mr. Barsh, go first.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, I'm happy to include our thoughts on that as we bring back some recommendations on a committee structure. I know that there have been instances where policy and finance committees have been combined. I would suggest that the one separation you may want to have, whether it's either through formal committee or through deadline, is a way for those committees to process policy-only issues out, either as a separate committee or out of a joint committee, so that when you get to the work of having doing separate finance work or budget bills, it doesn't also contain every piece of policy that might have been referred to that committee. But we'll consider that when we put together some recommendations.
Representative Peterson, there was a time, too, when we were much sharper on putting together omnibus bills. There would be bills that would be higher ed, K-12, transportation, health and human services, and they contained both finance and policy, but they were relatively tightly drawn, and the conference committee dealt only with that issue. I think one of the discussions we have for the last couple of sessions were these bills at the end that contained everything. Mm-hmm. And House File 1812 is the latest example, where it's an omnibus policy, finance, everything bill, very difficult to grasp any particular part of. And then when we took it apart, Representative Kahn alluded to this at the last meeting, putting it together was bad enough. Taking it apart was even worse. And then trying to delineate the parts, we should have done that first. It should have run, whatever it was, 14 different accounts. Those should have run as 14 different conference committee reports. And those conference committees should have dealt with them, but that's not what we did. And it didn't speed anything up here at all. And it then cascaded into errors. and some significant errors at the end. Representative Cox.
Just on that point exactly, one of the points, I think the reason that was done was that it gave leadership an illusion control, or an illusion of control at least. And I think one of the enormous waste of time, you know, we can think of legislative waste of time, but one of the enormous waste of time was that every one of those staff or those 14 or whatever they were, conference committees, had to sit through every bit of 1812. And if you weren't there, even though you had been assured that what you were looking at was in place and there was no need for you to be prepared, changes made and things happened. And so the thought is, you know, even when we have lots of committees, at least if they're meeting separately and concurrently, it's less of a waste of time than having to have everyone's concentration on only one stage.
Representative
Grant. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the two of you's assessment of that. And when we get around to the meeting on end of session process, I'd certainly like to be at that one, if you could announce when that is. And then for Representative Peterson's question also, why are they separate? You know, I can see why they're separate just because of time of covering everything, unless the Finance Policy Committee met more. And I think that would make sense, too. But what doesn't make sense is having different members on the Finance Committee from the Policy Committee, because we would have, you know, hearings on, you know, Representative Benson's technology and interactive whiteboards type hearing. And then because we had in the Finance Committee, we had to finance these things if we were going to. We had to hear it again because we didn't have all the finance members weren't on the Policy Committee. But for those of us who were on both, it was a colossal waste of time. And also for the people coming to present and testify, they had to do it twice. And so I would hope that in this recommendation for leadership for next year, that we would include, if there's going to be separate policy and finance committees, and I wouldn't argue for or against that, that at least the members of the Finance Committee, which is typically a smaller numbered committee, should all be on the Policy Committee, so there's not duplication.
Representative Peterson, there are scenarios here in the past where that actually existed, and where I was on K-12 policy, but the K-12 finance bill went through K-12 policy. So it was actually heard twice in both of those committees and amended in both of those committees. So you did have a significant number of the members doing it. There used to be a higher education finance and higher education policy committee. The same scenario occurred. And then they were clustered under an appropriations committee. There are several scenarios here that could be used, but I think the end of this, and this is the point that was made earlier, I think by Representative Olson, the end has become a particular problem because those pieces no longer operate independently. The last couple of sessions, they've been thrown together, and literally three people in one room have tried to decide things that are, as Mr. Neumeister pointed out, very complicated, and one sentence makes a big difference and has made a big difference. And we should leave that in those conference committees the way it had been in the past, so that when it comes to the floor, we at least have somebody who understands what's in the bill. And I don't think we saved any time by putting them all in one bill. We probably wasted more time than saved it. Representative Pierce, you had something else you wanted to say. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple quick points. First, I hope that we can agree on one specific change, and I know we're not acting on any recommendations here, and that is, I think it would be nice to be able to re-refer a bill directly to a division, assuming that we're going to keep the same structure of the finance divisions under the full finance committee. Instead of recommending it to the finance committee or referring it to the finance committee with a recommendation that it go to this, that, or the other division, I think being able to just leapfrog that and go right to the division, even if it only saves a day in one committee hearing, I think would be a good thing. Second, I just have to say, in terms of working groups, think groups, you know, all the rest of it, I would say that although those can seem to be a nuisance and there are lots to choose from, I just would say I don't think those are necessarily a bad thing. I've been a part of a couple of them myself. The problem is not everyone has a gavel. And so, and not everyone can convince someone with a gavel to hold a hearing on something, and that's fine. I don't think that necessarily should be the case. But if Representative Murphy, for example, who has a lot of expertise in healthcare, wanted to do something in healthcare but couldn't convince, for whatever reason, either the two committee chairs in the House to hold that hearing, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing for her to send around an email and say, hey, look, let's convene a group to discuss these issues and come back with recommendations. So while I think it is preferable to go through a standing committee, not everyone has a gavel or can convince someone with a gavel to hold that hearing. And then lastly, on 1812, I think this kind of foreshadows what we'll be talking about in the next committee meeting. To me, all roads lead to the lack of time limitations on the floor, or some limitation, procedural limitation, because I think one of the motivating reasons for doing 1812 the way it was done, the thinking at least was, well, do you want to have one 4 in the morning night? Let's get it out of the way. Or do you want to have 8 or 9 or 10 4 in the morning nights, where on the K-12 education bill there's 60 amendments, and on the environment bill there's 70 amendments, and on this, that, and the other bill there are literally dozens of amendments. And so if we had limitations either on numbers of amendments or on global time for bills, I think that would go a long way towards curbing the or curtailing the trend, I guess, of going to these massive omnibus everything bills.
And I just remind everyone, including the public, that on July 10th, the next hearing is on floor procedures, which is page 3 of the initial document. So we'll begin taking a look at that on July 10th. Representative Gulch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I my 2 points are points where I think the public is entirely left out of the system. And one was presented by Mr. Neumeister. In conference committees, sometimes provisions are put in that never did get a hearing anywhere. And unless the public knows that the provision is coming up in a conference committee, they would have no chance to debate or put in any input, even to the conference committee members, because they have no idea this is going to come out. And this happened to me this year, so that I know what I'm talking about here. But the other point is the double number of bills that we really have. When we have delete all amendments, we're really doubling our number of bills. And in many cases, it's for the betterment of a bill to have a delete all amendment. But that's another point where the public is really left out. I had a bill that I've been working on for 2 years, and it was laid over for possible inclusion into an omnibus bill, so there was no committee vote on it. And then the chair picks and chooses parts. So then when it goes to the conference committee, and I watched this year, a totally different provision was substituted that had never had a hearing. So there was never any vote, there was never any debate. And I think that the conference committee, since this is a meeting on committees, conference committees have to have some daylight put onto the process, because the public is totally left out of that process until it comes to the floor, and then it's too late unless they can have a legislator make a comment about it. But that's my 2 points.
Representative Khan, to the point.
Okay. Anytime you drive down Summit Avenue and you look at the approximately 32-year trees that are growing there, you can remember that the funding for the germ disease tree replacement, I think, came de novo into a conference committee at that time. So be careful about what you wish for.
Representative Schulte, your point is well taken. There were times here where a conference committee report contained only what was in one or the other bill. It was almost unheard of that an item that was not related in one or the other bill would have been included in a conference committee report. And this is a point that becomes a problem for us. And the second point is, when the conference committees dissolve, as they did in 2007, and never complete their work, that's another issue, because the work's left on the table and nobody knows what's going to go into the final bill, because again, it's moved now to totally leadership. And frankly, as good as they are, they do not know what's in those integral parts. So you raised a couple of points, and ones that we have to revisit. Are you done, Representative Wofford?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. One idea that I wanted to throw out is for us to have some discussion with the administration, though, about when administration bills come to us, because that really is part of the committee process and can sometimes really create more log jams or not, depending on when we get it. And it seems to me that it would be reasonable to talk with representatives of the administration. I know there are some deadlines currently in statute about when they submit bills, but it's always seemed reasonable to me to have the technical bills
you know, adjustments or miswording because the federal government has changed some minor provision related to implementation of something. There's a court case. For those technical bills to be ready and dealt with in the first week of session and just clear them out or at least be ready to be introduced. Sometimes we're getting those very, very late at a time when committee time is really at a premium for much more difficult issues to get worked out. And in terms of the major policy initiatives, you know, getting those out as soon after they're announced in the State of the State, the budget address, so that those also are ready for the public to weigh in and understand what the implementation issues are going to be. And then the third area where I think there needs to be some partnership discussions is the whole fiscal note area, because the ability to really even think about teeing a chairman to tee up a bill is sometimes dependent upon their understanding of whether or not it's realistic that it's going to be able to go through or what the committee really wants to understand what the fiscal implications of something are. And even within the finance division, they've been running into problems with getting a fiscal note before they have to report out the finance division's report. And so sometimes the whole process gets somewhat delayed because there isn't that partnership and understanding of the workload and workflow needs that we have. And so I would hope that we could have some discussions, whether it's in the committee process or informally with the administration, about, you know, how can we make this work better for everyone.
Representative Loeffler, you raise a good point, and we've been in contact with the administration. I don't know what's going to happen, but we had wanted someone from the administration to begin to respond to almost all the issues that you listed. So, and Representative Loeffler did send a document to us that we did include in the packet today, but we will. That was work that was done by Representative Finkelstein and Representative Loeffler together. Is that last session? It would have been not 2007, but it would have been the 2006. So that will be in the next packet. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just express a quick view without trying to belabor Representative Foppy's concerns about the number of committees. We heard testimony earlier from NCSL. The appropriate number of committees should be somewhere around 10 to 15. I think I heard somebody today, I'm not sure who it was, that said that there are 14 finance committees. That seems to fall in that category pretty well. I haven't been here long enough to know whether a good recommendation would be to have policy committees serve as a subset within finance committees or have finance committees serve as a subset within policy committees. But I would suggest that could be a way to reduce the number of committees, is somehow combining the finance and the policy committees in the same areas, have one be a subset of another in some way. Now, of course, if you're just going to have fewer committees, there are a couple of options on how to deal with that. One is the size of the committees can explode, which I don't think would be necessarily a good thing. The other thing that I think would be a good thing is for the number of committees any given member serves on to be smaller. And I think that will allow each of us to focus on areas of particular interest, whether it is to our own expertise or interests of our communities that we serve. And I think we can get more people offering better input on the committees they serve instead of just having more people serving on committees. So I would suggest that we consider that as we move forward to make recommendations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman.
I just have a brief follow-up on the point that Representative Scalzi raised. In the joint rules, we do have a provision that says the conference committee cannot include something that didn't pass either the House or the Senate. And I only know that because I wanted to get something in the conference committee that I thought would pass either the House or the Senate, but not both. But I don't remember reading what's the or else. I mean, and what I remember on the last day of session being somewhat grateful to you because I think you somewhat raised that issue with regard to 1812 as we passed it off the floor. But really the only way anybody could raise that topic was kind of to propose to set the whole legislature down and force a special session. But I think it's Joint Rule 2.03. I don't know what it is for sure, but that rule wasn't followed. But or what? Is there an or else or what?
Well, Representative Hortman, I believe the problem is the way House File 1812 was put together. one would argue there wasn't much of a conference committee involved in putting that together, that it was put together in the governor's office with two other people, not exactly what you would call a conference committee. And when I stood up on the House floor, there were unintended consequences that were rather significant that had not been explained to me until the bill was in its final form we're voting on it. So I think your point's well taken, but again, this goes back to Representative Scalzi's point. The conference committees have to remain intact. And if they don't, if there's no conference committee, then I don't think there's exactly a rule in the classic sense. Now, I realize there was a conference committee that met on House File 1812, but that might have been a ghost conference committee for some other committee that was meeting in the governor's office, or group of people. I wouldn't even term it a committee.
Well, that's certainly one example, but I think there's lots of other examples. I do remember in 2006 the natural resources bill being drafted in a Senate office by a group of people, a large number of whom were from the range, and you know, and those provisions were sort of agreed upon informally, not at a public meeting, and then that became the conference committee report. But nobody brings up, oh, but you're not complying with the joint house rules. And I guess this kind of goes to the heart of what we're doing, is we might recommend some really great rules, but if we don't follow them, or if there's no or else, then kind of what's the point? We have a rule where we can call a question, but that's like the nuclear option. You know, you're starting World War III if you call a question. I guess what's the consequence of not following our rules?
Representative Horman, the consequence, I believe, is where we're at right now.
I just hope we can have some impact to change that. I mean, if we can adopt all the good rules in the world.
Representative Horman, and again, your observation here is why we are here. In all of the years I've been here, we've never had a standing committee of the House take a look at anything in this much detail and then open it up to members to come in and have input. I can't guarantee you what will happen in 2009. I only know that for the first time there will be a list of suggestions, and we will have a cross-section of members who will say, when you put the rules together, here are some things that should be included in those rules. And I imagine a much different debate in 2009 on the rules than we had 2 years ago. At least I hope there will be one. And I hope it will be led by the first, second, and third termers. Counting on them. Representative Garofalo, thank you for coming today.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to start my remarks by saying that if you know, if I was to pick one person in this House chamber to lead this discussion on this matter, I would choose you. And I'm really appreciative of the efforts you're doing in this matter. And I'm not just saying that because I'm going to ask for per diem today. Mr. Chairman and Representative Horman, regarding the rules and how this happens, it's important for us to remember that whatever rules we have in place, whatever dynamics are out there, the rules are whatever 68 of us say they are. Mm-hmm. And when my side was in control, there were certainly the example you brought up. It seems to me there was a bonding bill in 2005 where a provision just literally came out of nowhere, the first bonding bill of 2005. So my side of the aisle did that. And, you know, with the other side of the aisle now in control of things, we've seen examples of that as well. And I'm sure when my side comes back in the majority next session, we will we'll break those rules again. But just remember, the rules are what 68 of us say they are. Mr. Chairman, with regards to the structure of the committees, I think, you know, points two and three, reducing the numbers of committees, reducing the numbers of members on each of those committees are effective. But also I wanted to point out item five on page two, which is the custom of the rules regarding minority-majority splits. And I know that it may be easier for me as a minority member right now to advocate for this, but for a more closely divided or a more narrow range of division in the numbers of each party, the reality is the process we have in place here is set up for consensus and compromise. As much as we may not like that sometimes, it's really the way the system is set up. And with all the fights we have, at the end of the day, it takes both sides to make something happen. And even if one party does have control of the entire process, the legislative process and the executive branch are a self-correcting mechanism. When one party controls everything, the electorate pretty swiftly changes that and puts for a division of power in place. So I would just, again, on point 5A, I think that's an important rule that
having the committees be more narrow in terms of the partisan divide, some may construe as making it more difficult for the majority party to advance their agenda. But in reality, if those provisions need a supermajority from the majority party to get through the committee process, chances are they're not going to become law anyways, that at some point in the process it's going to break down. So, and Mr. Chairman, my final point is with regards to the committee process, and I apologize if this has been brought up, but we need to change the timing of when the budget forecast comes out in February. We waste 2 months where literally we can't do anything. The budget forecast right now, I believe it's under statute, comes out. It's coming out at the end of February. It should come out earlier in February or late January, so we have more time to act on that. And that budget forecast, as much as we fight about things, we're frozen. We can't do anything in terms of the governor's office presenting a budget, in terms of the legislature assigning budget targets. We can't do much until the budget forecast comes out. And with regard to trying to accelerate that, that might be a burden on the executive branch. But as a member of the legislative branch, I think that would be an important policy consideration. I apologize for the length of my remarks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further discussion? We've gone a little beyond our required time. Any discussion any member wishes to make at this time? Then our next meeting will be July 10th. It will be at 10 a.m. We'll be looking at floor procedures, and if members wish to get us any information prior to that, we're again going to open it up to all members. So we've only got a couple other areas to go through, and then we will have the final meeting, and I anticipate to have that before the end of summer, so before we get into the fall. So any further discussion? Seeing none, the meeting is adjourned.